Yo, what is a cypher?
You gotta make people like you for a lot of different things as an artist. Yeah.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 167, a talk with Jermaine Dupri. Dupri got his start in hip-hop very young. As a preteen, he was a dancer on the Fresh Fest tour of the mid-1980s. He quickly went from there to rapping himself, but found that his real talent lay in writing and producing hits for others. He had his first real success with the group Crisscross, who he discovered in 1991. From there, he formed So So Def Records and had huge hits with Escape, DeBrat, Jagged Edge, and Lil Bow Wow. Dupri also had many hits as a producer with the likes of Mariah Carey, Destiny's Child, and Usher. In fact, Usher's iconic album Confessions was actually based on Dupri's own complicated love life. Jermaine Dupri is now a key part of two unscripted TV shows, The Rap Game and BET's Music Moguls. We talked with him at the offices of Big Machine Agency in Manhattan. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it drops, subscribe on your podcast app of choice. Once you do that, you'll be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another noted Southern rapper and producer, Mississippi's David Banner, on episode 164. Also consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every single week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. For September, we're working on putting together something great for you. Become a patron by September 16th at noon Eastern to get access to the file. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's that guy from the Houdini video, Jermaine Dupri. You know, I think everyone really wants to know, when can we expect the Chad and Jermaine album?
A Chad and Jermaine album?
Yeah.
Oh God, I don't. Chad doesn't rap anymore.
Chad and Jermaine was a duo consisting of Dupri and Chad Elliott. They put out a four-song single in 1986 when Dupri would have been around 13 years old and Elliott 15. Chad Elliott went on to have a successful career as a producer, songwriter, mixer, and engineer. He also eventually went on to become vice president of Sony Urban.
Well, it's funny because that single you guys put out, it actually says on it, you can see here, I have a little, printed out a little picture. It says, from the forthcoming album, that's a wrap. You can see that.
Oh my God, look at this. Oh, I got to tweet this.
So was there ever anything recorded for That's a Wrap?
No. That's crazy. Where did you find this?
I was just floating around, you know, in the world. The songs are out there too, actually.
This is crazy.
All four of them. So what do you remember about that, you know, recording those songs? Because you did the lyrics and stuff, but other people did the music.
Yeah, just writing. This is my beginning, my writing.
Yeah.
This is the beginning.
Was the fact that you didn't have a hand in the music, did that kind of lead to you becoming a producer?
Yes, that pretty much has what drove me to becoming a producer. Well, I wanted to do things with That's a Rap album, I'm guessing, that the people that were making the records weren't actually paying attention to. So I was just like, yo, it forced me to want to just make it. If I could do this and I could do this, if I could do that, he could do that, I could figure it out. So it just made me just go really, really hard with my craft.
Right, because the beats are like, I don't even know if you remember, but they're, you know, it's 86 or whatever. Like, there's kind of a little bit of an electro influence left over in some of the stuff.
Jam on!
It wasn't nothing compared to what I started doing, you know, sampling and making, you know, the that was a lot tougher than what we was making.
Right. So you were writing rap lyrics at, you know, 12, 13 years
old. Yeah, 100%, yes.
How did that play into the lyrics you ended up writing for other 13-year-old rappers later on?
It trained me to basically understand the writing process, period, and understand that I can write for anyone long as I know them and I write specifically about what it is that they do.
And, you know, so I was listening to an older interview you did, and you said, you know, obviously you lived in New York on and off during kind of the mid and late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And you let it slip that your roommate, or during that period, or one of your roommates, was a good friend of the show, a previous guest on our show, and a friend of mine, Say Adams.
Yeah. That's my
crazy.
Guy.
What was it like living with Say?
Well, I didn't work with him. I was just kicking it with him.
Yeah.
Just, like, hanging it with him. I became like a sidekick to Say that he probably didn't even know he was going to have, or even wanted. I just was like bugging him about graffiti and art, and just love being around him.
And so, you know, during that whole period, you were, for 3 years, you were on the first arena tour ever in hip hop, the Fresh Fest, for 3 years, 84 through 86.
The Fresh Fest, properly titled the Swatchwash New York City Fresh Festival, was a tour that began in 1984. It was the largest hip hop tour ever at that point, making an unprecedented $3.5 million. In its first year, the tour featured four breakdancing crews, as well as Nucleus, The Fat Boys, Houdini, Curtis Blow, and headliners Run DMC. Houdini's video for The Freaks Come Out at Night, which features a young Dupree, was shot on that tour. Legendary street artist Keith Haring designed the artwork for the tour, which appeared on t-shirts, posters, and Swatch watches, which now sell for upwards of $1,000.
Were you aware that, like, hey, this is a big deal for rap music?
No,
like,
not at all. Me and Chad laugh about it every day because it's like, we don't laugh. Well, we do laugh, but it's like the things that we were given on that tour are historical things that we don't even have anymore. And like, what's the guy who made the Swatch watches at that time were,
Oh, right. I saw a flyer from, I think, the 84 tour the other day, and they had, some of the Swatch people on there.
Yeah, it was all of that stuff. It was like, but the Swatch watches were made by, Keith Haring.
Okay.
So Keith Haring was out on the tour.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Keith Haring, and he came out with the Swatch watch, the Keith Haring Swatch watch edition. I think he was out on a tour, if I'm remembering. But we had, like, this original Keith Haring Swatch watches.
Wow.
And it was like I had probably 50 of them.
And don't know where they are now?
And don't know where they are now.
If you had just one.
It's like, it's so crazy because it was like none of that felt like history. Like, we didn't know we was actually in a historic moment. Mm-hmm. We just was being kids.
Right. And in some ways, you can see that through line throughout your career. I'm thinking of, like, you know, Curtis Blow was on one of those tours. And then years later, you remade one of his songs.
Yeah.
Right? You remade Basketball.
Yeah.
Number one, Curtis Blow. Basketball is my favorite sport. I like the way to dribble up and down the court. Just like I'm the king on the microphone. So it's Dr. J and Moses Malone.
I like slam dunk to take me to the hoop. Yeah. My favorite play is the alley-oop. I like to pick and roll. I like to give and go. And it's basketball. Bow wow. Let's go.
That's crazy. What was it like? Because we've had the guy who wrote that, or one of the writers, Rocky Ford. We've had, you know, I've sat down with him. I've talked to him. What was it like remaking Basketball for you? Did you feel, because you knew Curtis back then, any kind of kinship to the song?
No, not at all. I wasn't even actually thinking about that. I was just thinking about how Bow Wow didn't know the record.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah. Like, it was like, wow, this is like, this was a big song in my, you know, when I was a kid, but I introduced the Bow Wow, he didn't even know the song. And it's like, wow, you don't know the record. It's crazy. You know what I mean? That's why I actually redid the entire record.
Mm-hmm.
from start to finish, because it was like, I figured if Bow Wow didn't know the song, then nobody else knew the song.
Right. And, you know, I wanted to ask about an influence on you from who was popular during that era, who you don't really talk about, and who I think is kind of overlooked a little bit, not even in terms of sound, but in terms of, like, how he dealt with his career, how he dealt with artists, and that's Herbie Lovebug.
Yeah.
Herbie Lovebug Azor is a producer and songwriter best known for discovering Salt-N-Pepa and writing and producing much of their early material. He also discovered Kid and Play and produced classic records by Dana Dane, Kwame, and Vogue, and more.
Can you talk a little bit about him?
Well, that was my idol. You know what I mean? That's, you know, as far as, like, the collecting of groups. Like, Herbie created a company, and he just started putting out multiple groups, Salt-N-Pepa, Kid and Play, Kwame, Antoinette. I'm trying to remember if I'm leaving anybody out, but he was just like, that was his thing. He was putting out multiple artists under his umbrella. And I basically took that idea and was like, that's how I want my label to be. I wanted to be multiple different talented artists.
Yeah. And what the first artist you brought out after, you know, the retiring of Chad and Jermaine?
Yeah, it was Crisscross.
Well, was Six Times Leather. Yeah, of course. Can't forget that.
Yeah.
It's true that I'm a hip hop queen. My rhymes are my weapons. My look is mean. So when you see me, all you can do is dwell. I'm hip. I ever call me leather. She's the F and the L. I'm prepared to rock like
Silk Times Leather was an all female rap trio put together by Dupree. The group consisted of Vicky Silk Jordan, Diana Diamond X Lewis, and Jocelyn Leather Rabone. As Dupree mentions here, he wrote and produced all the material on their 1990 album, It Ain't Where You're From, It's Where You're At.
So that was the first album you wrote on, as yes. opposed to performing on.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you make that transition from writing lyrics to yourself for, like, hey, I'm, you know, this is me, I'm rapping under my own name, to writing lyrics for women you didn't really know that well?
Well, I knew them pretty well. I got a chance to, you know, I got an opportunity to really hang around the girls, and I knew them pretty well. But the lyrics weren't personal like that. The lyrics were just raps.
Now I come talk with the huff and park your bones down, all because you're not rough enough to face the sound of the L from the SL staff. So follow the path that you feel my rap. Yo, let me kick it to you.
I just had a bunch of ideas that I felt like needed to be heard. And if you introduce the ideas, and I felt one of the ideas was you guys should be rappers, and I'm gonna write for y'all. I'm gonna have songs for y'all every day. Y'all come over here, y'all learn these songs. And if you stick by what you're saying, people will follow it pretty much. And if you got a good enough plan that's pretty much structured right, people will follow that and pay attention to it.
And what were you thinking musically when putting stuff together for them? Because that was your first real, you know,
I was just
production.
Trying anything, trying to get, you know, trying to get heard as a producer, and make a. I was trying to make a hit, though. I was trying to make records that had some kind of thing about them that was big for a female. I just couldn't figure it out at that particular point in time, but I was trying.
Right. And, you know, I wanted to ask about sampling, because a lot of your early mid-90s stuff, you know, the Crisscross, TLC, Escape, all that kind of stuff, uses samples. A lot of them are, you know, now well-known. How did you think about sampling back then?
I didn't. I just used to sample. Just like, whatever, as many records as I could get my hands on felt like the movie Johnny Five. I was like the little robot dude. I was just like
input.
Input, more input.
Yeah, input. Like, that's how it was. Whatever records I could find, I was trying to download them into my system. Because that's what we couldn't download records back then. So you had to download them into your system and know the record.
Right.
Mentally be like, This I'm gonna listen to this record and Bob Skaggs and this person and just so many different people. Like, why am I listening to this guy? Oh, okay, I heard somebody talking about him. I should check out his music, right?
Yeah,
there's just so many different things that just used to drive you know to find music.
Yeah, and you know there was one particular sample that I wanted to ask about because you use it, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 times in that period. Which is the ringing phone from Last Night Changed It All.
Hello?
Hey, woman, what was you at last night?
Yeah.
Oh, really? I did. Records I did.
Use that. I forget. There's like a
that's
TLC
crazy.
And maybe there's like one or two others where it's, you know, not just the phone ringing. So.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I mean, that beat. Well, I was hypnotized by break beats. Mm-hmm. Chad had introduced me to breaks, mm-hmm. and so I got my hands on breaks. But the way breaks used to seem here in New York, they seemed like something that was so magical and so classic. Like, it used to be like you could turn on the radio for hours and Red Alert and Chuck Chill Out would be just playing break beats. And just knowing the break and how to catch the break and letting just a little bit of the music play and then come back with the break, it just seemed, it was so magical to me that when I got my hands on them, I was trying to use every one of the breaks. That was just it. And break beats to me are as bad as having a drug addiction as a producer, because
I saw that Crate Diggers episode did there where you just bought a whole record store.
Well, I bought a whole record store one day, basically. I went into a store that was going out of business and I told them I wanted all the soul records that they had, all the urban music, everything that they had. And they was like, here, you know, I think it was like $1,500 for me to buy all the records. So I bought every record that was in the record store. So, you know, and you know.
Yeah, to me, when you use a breakbeat on a record and it works, you want to use it. You want to use a breakbeat every time. Because mm-hmm. the sound of a break, the way, what it does for your records, it just makes you, you know, pulling myself away from breaks was like hard as hell.
I was going to ask about that because at a certain point, sample laws tightened up and you couldn't. Sample.
Well, I didn't care about that. It's not about the tightening up. But yeah, I'm a musician, so a lot of times I don't have to sample. So and a lot of it was deliberate because I wanted to make sure that I was pulling myself away from like sampling all the time.
Mm-hmm. And what role did Manuel Seal play in that?
Manuel Seal is a musician, record producer, composer, singer, songwriter, vocal coach, and arranger. His first major success came in working with Dupri on Escape, and the two have since collaborated on a ton of projects.
Because you started working with him right at around that period where you're kind of weaning yourself off samples.
He helped me get away from the samples because he could replay the music. Mm-hmm. So on Brat's album, majority of all the records was replays. And that was like my first walk in down that road of just feeling comfortable or not, saying, oh, I don't have to sample it no more. I got Manuel. Manuel can replay all of this.
Sing the hook.
Yeah, this shit will sound just as good.
Yeah, he's great. You work with him on a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that was my partner, my musical partner for almost 15 years.
Wow. In that sort of mid-90s era of your production, you use on a lot of songs the acoustic guitar specifically as kind of a prominent instrument.
I'm going through a situation that I can't help. Uh-huh. Want to get a little closer, but I promise myself.
On the dot, I'm in my drop.
What draws you towards that sound on a kind of like R&B
stuff? That was Manuel, basically.
That was him.
Manuel played the acoustic guitar, and that was him. A lot of times I just hear him hitting riffs, and I was just like, we should use this.
Okay. And, you know, as far as production goes, you were one of the first people, you know, other people were sort of hinting around this, but you were one of the first people to really have singers sing over more hip hop sounding beats.
Mm-hmm.
How has it been for you to see that become like the default mode for R&B now, where it's almost impossible for contemporary R&B to actually sound like anything else?
It's not really, because that's how I always saw R&B music anyway. I felt like R&B music, when I started making R&B music, wasn't hip enough for me. not the young people. I'm the young person. So I didn't think that it was hip enough for me. Right. So I needed to make R&B music that was hip enough for me to want to listen to. And I feel like that just happened to become the wave. Like, it wasn't, the music just wasn't hip enough for no one to listen to at its, in its old form. Mm-hmm. It had to come into that, you know, the beats had to become harder, and it had no reason, it was no reason for the beats not to become harder.
Right. And, you know, you worked with Xscape and TLC more or less the same time. Mm-hmm. They're very different groups. Xscape was very much kind of on the vocal harmony yes. tip more than TLC. What role did you play in their vocal arrangements, their harmonies, stuff like that? Did you suggest harmonies work on vocal arrangements?
Oh, no. Well, Xscape came to me singing like that. How they came. TLC, we kind of built their sound. TLC sound came from this one song that I've created called I Got It Going On.
Was that released?
Huh? No, it was never released. And the way T-Boss sang on that record was the way that every song from that day forth sounded from TLC.
Mm-hmm. So that was your concept
of
the group?
Like, well, TLC, the sound of TLC, well, that was my concept.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask about Xscape for one second.
Okay.
So you have the debut album, right? But then the second one, Off the Hook, is pretty big growth. There's like different kinds of instruments and different kinds of arrangements and things like that. Can you talk about that process of evolving the group sound?
Yeah, I wanted Xscape to become as big as Boyz II Men as a female group.
Mm.
So I was trying to do everything I could think of to send them to just from just being this smaller R&B group to becoming the world known group Xscape. So I wanted bigger songs. I was looking for a Diane Warren record and.
Diane Warren, who did not write anything for Off the Hook, Dupree is just saying that he wanted a song that sounded like she could have written it, is one of the most successful pop songwriters of all time. At one point, she had 7 songs by 7 different artists on the Billboard charts simultaneously. Her biggest hits include Rhythm of the Night, Unbreak My Heart, Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now, Blame It on the Rain, If I Could Turn Back Time, I Don't Want to Miss a Thing, and scores of others, including 32 top 10 hits and 9 number ones.
Vocally, nobody could mess with these girls as far as I was concerned. And they could sing anything. They could damn near sing their way out of a paper bag if you put them in there. And I was just like, just give them these big songs. Let's give these girls these songs. Jermaine, don't hold them back. Try to give them as big as records as possible.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you kind of got all the way there with that? Or do you think you missed something?
I think I went all the way with it. I think that what that did was teach me that image is 25 to 35% of entertainment business. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the girl's image ever connected with pop culture to the point where then it would have been the same thing that I think Beyonce has. Like, musically, it would have been great. The girl's look would have been amazing. Then you had a fuse of people just really wanting to. Oh, what's going on with these guys? Love them for the look. You got to make people like you for a lot of different things as an artist. And I think Xscape missed the boat on being sexy to the world because I wasn't really promoting that.
Mm-hmm. And you actually got to see Beyonce very early on.
Oh, yeah.
Right? 97, 98, around there, recording for the first album.
Yeah.
Did she stand out among the group members back then?
Yeah, because, I mean, she was the lead. So, right. The lead's always going to stand out. But not to the point where I knew she would be what she is today.
Right. You're not like, this is going to be an icon in 15 years.
You can't. I mean, I don't know that I could ever tell you that someone's going to be an icon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that good.
Specifically, stuff on the 20-year-old album, the Janet record, a couple, like two or three of the songs you did there are like super stripped down and minimal, just kind of like a groove, and that's almost it.
No words are suitable to describe your swag, babe. And my body is an overdrive, and I have you inside, babe. I said that I don't like to rush, so I step back, make it work forward, fall back, and see about your wallet.
Just talk about the tracks you made for that record and kind of what you were thinking about.
It's hard for me to actually really remember the records on 20YO. I think, no, matter of fact, I take it back. One of the songs, I think, let me pull it up, that I hate that people didn't actually get is on that album.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that it was pretty amazing. I thought it was a pretty amazing song. I just don't think people wanted to hear, I don't know if they wanted to hear that type of music from Janet at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was a pretty amazing song. Was it With You? I think that's what it is.
With You?
Yeah, I thought that song probably should have been, I felt like people missed that album. I mean, that song.
Mm-hmm.
More than any song that I did, I think that was like the one. Let me see, I got it right here. Like, to me, this song is everything that Confessions is to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the crazy part about it is I didn't write it.
Feel a connection with the babe. I need enough, I crave for it to remain pure.
Dupri is actually credited as a writer on With You, along with Manuel Seal, Janet Jackson, Jonte Austin, Jimmy Jam, and Terry Lewis.
I didn't write the song, so it might not have the same. The writing is a little different to the track, but mm-hmm. I just thought that was a song that should have gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So looking back at Mariah Carey's career, right? In retrospect, it's pretty obvious to say, oh, Daydream is where she pulled away from her Svengali's and started being more hip hop and all this kind of stuff. Like, that's the narrative now. And you obviously played a big part in that. Was that something you were aware of at the time, that she wanted to kind of go in that direction? Was that something people were talking about, or is that only obvious in retrospect?
That's all Mariah. Going hip-hop is all Mariah. Mm-hmm. Nobody else had anything to do with that. That's 100% her.
Mm-hmm.
That's her thing.
Mm-hmm.
When she wanted to go hip-hop, how hard she wants to go, and all of that stuff is all in Mariah's head.
Mm-hmm. And so when you sat down with her for Long Ago, that was...
Ago wasn't really as hip-hop. It was kind of hip-hop. It was just like a little sample.
Once upon a time, you whispered softly in my ear. Loving words of fairy tales that I long to hear.
The stuff that she wanted to do when we made Long Ago was like crazy.
Really?
I couldn't believe it.
What was it? You remember?
Like, she wanted me to sample. I think we redid Cream.
I grew up on the crime side, the New York Times side. Staying alive was no job at secondhand.
The Wu-Tang Cream record, we did that. It didn't come out right, but we did it. We redid it.
Mm-hmm.
For her. There's a bunch of records that we was just like messing with to get to songs. But at that particular point in time, I was so nervous about messing up my opportunity to produce the great Mariah Carey, that I wasn't trying to actually do all the sampling stuff that she wanted me to do at the particular point in time. I was like, yo, let's keep it musical.
The other song you did is a more straight ahead.
Yeah, that's why I always thing. Do my baby is what it is. Because I was just like, you know, but Always Be My Baby sounds like an Escape record. Then that's what she wanted. She wanted something that felt like something I would have done with Escape, but put that Mariah thing on top of it.
Mm-hmm. Crazy. And I found out, somehow I had missed this, but you did a remix of All I Want for Christmas Is You.
So dead.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. Uh-uh. There is just one thing I need.
Was there any kind of pressure there to remake a song that's like so beloved that everyone knows, everyone can kind of sing along to?
Nah, I mean, that's fun. When that's the thing, that's the beauty of doing remixes, because people, matter of fact, my best remixes come from when you know the song already.
Mm-hmm.
If I ever remix a record that's not known, I don't really have the energy. But if I get the chance to remix a record that's known, it makes me really dig and go do something, because I know that I got an opportunity to make this record last longer than what it's already been lasting.
Makes sense. And you know, you were talking about Mariah singing over Cream and stuff. You have her singing over G-Thing on one of her later albums.
Did I?
Yeah. It was...
I don't remember. But I mean, that's all Mariah, though. Mariah's always wanting to do... She's the hip-hop thing. Mm-hmm. When it comes to me and her, she's the hip-hopper. I'm the R&B guy. When it comes...
Yeah, it was... You had your chance. You had her singing over G-Thing.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. All right.
So, Usher, I wanted to ask about... You know, you've talked about Confessions over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
One of the funniest things about it, though, is you've been very clear that... You were writing about your life, and it was coming out of Usher's mouth.
Yeah.
It's gonna be the hardest thing I think I ever had to do. Got me talking to myself, asking how I'm gonna tell you. About that chick on part one, I told y'all I was creeping with. Say she's 3 months pregnant, and she's keeping it. The first thing that came to mind.
And the whole press cycle, you were clear about that. Everyone was clear about that. But somehow it got twisted enough to the point where Usher's then girlfriend actually thought the songs were about him, right?
In a 2014 interview with Complex, Dupri talked about what happened when Confessions Part 2, which he wrote for Usher, became a hit. Dupri said, Part 2 was all me, my whole life story, basically. I think Usher loved it because it was mysterious. It was so mysterious that Chilli actually started believing it. She started believing that these songs were about her. I heard her do an interview one day, and she was talking about it like we wrote about her. No way.
Because, you know, like, how many people tell you that they wrote a song about their life and somebody else sings it? Like...
That
story is not really the most believable story out there. It's easier to believe that Usher has a girl on the side and he's doing all this shit that's in the songs. It's easier to believe that.
Mm-hmm.
To believe that Jermaine is that good and he's written a song that's his life, but he gave it to you to make it seem like it's yours, sounds too complicated for people.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's easier to believe the opposite. So it's just like, basically, like, Jermaine's trying to make himself look good as a writer, as a producer, but that story, that's Usher. Usher's doing this. And I mean, that's what I wanted people to do.
Right. You want people to believe that it's his story, right?
Yeah, I wanted people to believe it 100%.
Yeah. So you started working with Usher. He was already gold, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't a giant star.
Yeah.
Then you do My Way.
But she's still gonna give it up. She likes it my way.
Multi-platinum. Yes. How did you make that leap? What did you do to get him a bigger audience?
I just felt like, like I said, I heard the records that he was making. I knew we had a lot of conversations, and I just knew that he wanted to spread his wings, and I knew that he had the wings to spread.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had to go deep and write songs that I felt like would allow him to become much more of a artist that he wanted to be.
Okay. And one of the few disappointments in your career has been the Usher Live album. Didn't get good reviews, didn't sell well. What went wrong with that?
I wasn't part of it.
No, you're credited on it as mixing of it.
Dupri is actually credited as a producer on Usher's 1999 Live album, as well as with backing vocals on one song. In addition, he remixed one song.
I think Nice and Slow was mm-hmm. like the live version of Nice and Slow was on there, something like a remix.
There is actually a remix of Nice and Slow on the album. However, the song Dupri remixed is My Way.
I do mean everything you want to make your girl say, ooh, ooh, why is he so fly? She feeds me.
Nothing new. It was like all just like live music.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't even pay attention to that album.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a live album. I mean, it's not. I don't think I never even paid attention as an album of even selling. Like, you know what I mean? It's just a live album.
Mm-hmm. I got you. And you know, a lot of the hip hop stuff you did when you were starting out with Criss Cross and the Brat, It doesn't, at least to my ear, sound like Southern in the way that people would think of Southern records maybe 10 years later. It almost has more of like a West Coast feel to it, stuff that would come to be associated with that. You know, you'll sample more Bounce to the Ounce, you'll have like the Funky Worm sample and that kind of stuff. Talk a little bit about West Coast hip hop and your relationship to it back then.
What's crazy is that when I did jump, G Thing hadn't even come out. So,
oh really?
Yeah, not in 92. I don't think G Thing had come out when Crisscross came out. So I actually was doing that sound before Dre even started exploiting that type of sound.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was on that. I mean, those records just resonated to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But then, you know, later on in Crisscross, you sampled the voices of a couple of the NWA members, right? Ice Cube and Easy.
Yeah. Stuff, well, so. I mean, on Lil Boys in the Hood, that's Ice Cube and Easy connected from samples. But this is what we see growing up as little boys in the hood.
When Bow Wow came out, right, he was 12, but you'd already been working with him since he was 10. Mm-hmm. Similar thing with Crisscross. I don't know, they came out when they were 13 or something, but you discovered them.
11 and 12, yeah.
11 and 12.
Mm-hmm.
What was going on during those two-year periods? What were you teaching these kids? How do you prepare kids for, you know,
just trying to get them to understand my mindset of what I'm actually going to do. Because, you know, you bring them in the room and I'm like, listen, you guys don't rap. But you know everybody's rap records. Like, you know Ice Cube songs. You know this song. So if I write a song for you, I want you to learn it the way you know these other guys' songs, and it's going to be your song. And actually getting them to understand that method was what that two-year process was. Once they started wrapping their head around, oh, we could be rappers that easy if we learn the songs he's making them for us. If we learn them the way we learn other people's songs. So the pressure I had was I had to make songs that they liked as much as they liked all the adult records.
Ah.
Yeah.
Yep. Bow Wow's delivery on that first album is actually pretty good.
Yeah.
He's doing, you know, some faster stuff and interesting cadences and stuff. You heard of me, had to. I'm that little bad dude running around putting it down with JD. I'm the ace in the hit. I'm the prince of the clip. What you think? Keep making sure he had a bitch. It's the beat.
Well, Bow Wow was different. Bow Wow came as a rapper.
Oh, okay.
He already was rapping. So Bow Wow's project was a little different because he already was a rapper.
So you just had to kind of shape.
He didn't want to rap about the stuff that I was writing. So I had to get him in that mindset as well. Bow Wow's first name was called Lil Gangsta, and he was signed to Death Row. On the Snoop Dogg album, when the dude is in the classroom and he says, "Hey, you back there with the French braids, what do you want to be when you grow up?" And he said, "I want to be a motherfucking gangster."
My name is Snoop.
Hi, Snoop. What you want to be when you grow up?
I want to be a motherfucking hustler. You better ask somebody.
That's Bow Wow.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. And so then you had to kind of go.
I mean, Bow Wow's direction. Mindset of what he wanted to do was be a gangster, little hardcore rapper. And I knew that he could be bigger if you cleaned it up in the different things that we talked about.
And, you know, you've obviously talked a lot about Money and a Thing, but I wanted to hone in on one specific aspect of it, which is the hook of it is an old Jay-Z line from two albums prior that you specifically repurposed into the hook. I'm deep in the south, kicking up top game, bouncing on the highway, switching four lanes, screaming through the sunroof, money ain't a thing. A Ferrari, a Jaguar, switching four lanes, top down, screaming out, money ain't a thing. Bubble hard in the double law, flashing the rings with the window crack, holla back, money ain't a thing. Jigga, I don't like. Had you heard of anyone doing that before?
At the time when I did it?
Yeah, at the time when you did it, back in, you know, 97, 98, whenever you recorded it.
That's a great question. It's probably the best question ever about that song. I don't know. I don't know what made me say we was gonna use that part of the hook. I think I had done it before though. I had tried to do that many a times and been scared because, you know, if the artist ain't there, then you won't get away with it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if anybody else had ever done it. You're right.
It's crazy. And I have to ask about, just because you sound like you're having so much fun on the record you did with Slick Rick.
Yes.
You're doing your best Slick Rick impression the whole time.
Live fresh, like a million bucks.
Come on. Kids, Jermaine Dupri with. Walking down the street, you know, minding my own biz. My man girlfriend started acting like she.
Hey, Jay-Z, where you find going?
It just sounds like.
Well, I mean,
so
that's who. I mean, honestly, that's my favorite rapper. Mm-hmm. If I was to rap, just stayed a full rapper, that's how I probably would have rapped, because the way his tone, his flow, his stories, the way he flowed, and the stacks and all of that is so much of what I love to do. Mm-hmm. So when I got an opportunity to make a song with him. I was like a kid in a candy store. Like, this is my idol. As far as jewelry, he's the one that made me want, like, you see this ring? This is like Slick Rick, a baby Slick Rick ring, because he was so gaudy and the chains was so heavy and mm-hmm. everything was just so, he was hip hop to me. Like, he was the ultimate rapper to me, as far as, like, if you're going to be a fly rapper, he was the flyest rapper that they could ever be. You know, so
yeah,
I always wanted to be Slick Rick, 100%.
And you've had this thing in your career where you've produced some more veteran artists, Isley Brothers, Aretha, Lionel Richie, people like that.
I had the finest cars, the biggest star, but I tell you, it's nothing like a beautiful woman. That's what.
On tape.
Dear, you're
wonderful. I really mean it, babe.
More than you will ever know. Wish that I could stay.
When you're dealing with these kind of legacy artists, what are you thinking? Are you thinking like, oh, I have to make a song that sounds like their old stuff so the fans will know? Or you think, I want to bring my, you know, I want to update them to what I'm doing? Where is that balance for you?
I'm thinking, what do they not have? The same thing I think about anybody else. Like, when I worked with Usher, the same thing I was saying, like, what does he not have? Mm-hmm. What is a record that Usher doesn't have? Let me give him that. Same thing with Aretha. I'm thinking, like, okay, Aretha Franklin is Aretha Franklin, but she doesn't have this. We need to give her one of these. Mm-hmm. What would sound dope? What would be a dope Aretha Franklin record right now if she was singing over this?
Right.
And, you know what I mean? So Every record is always approached like that. What is the person, what don't they have? Let me hear what you have. So they'll play me a couple of songs and I'm like, oh, okay, I got it. I don't think you have this.
Right. Crazy. And so, you know, business-wise, you obviously got a lot going on right now. The new season of The Rap Game debuts as we're talking. It debuts tomorrow.
Yes.
Listeners will already have seen it.
My expectations for this season are even higher.
Nobody wants to go home.
What can you tell me about season 2 of The Rap Game?
The education of culture. The education of the culture is higher, much, much higher on this season. The do's and don'ts of being a rapper and wanting to be a rapper is so much more prevalent on this. The things that the kids have to do, and even like the kids themselves show me, and they show themselves that they might not be ready. Like, you know, people that think they're ready, this is a look at people that think they're ready but learn that they're not ready.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the biggest lesson that people gonna learn, that people need to learn about the entertainment business, because there's a lot of people out here that's like, that think they're ready, and they get in and they might get a hit, but then they still be messing up and doing stuff that makes you believe, like, how did they get a record deal, right?
And what's that difference? Is that kind of artist development you did with your acts?
Yeah, it's just really just mostly like having a crash course like the rap game. Like you asked me about Crisscross. Every time I have an artist that I've had that people didn't document, I had them a year before they actually came out. Like, so it was like it was the rap game process for Bow Wow and Crisscross before their records came out.
And with Bow Wow, he's managed to transition into an adult career as an actor, as a rapper,
mm-hmm.
in a way that unfortunately Crisscross really wasn't able to.
Yeah.
What's different?
Bow Wow's an actor more than he is a rapper.
Shortly after we recorded this interview, Bow Wow announced that he was going to retire from rapping after he releases his upcoming album.
That's a natural thing that's in him. He is an actor. He can act. He can do that at any given point and in given time and any role that you throw at him, I believe he could do it. Crisscross, they were more or less into being cool kids.
Which is how you met him in the first place,
yeah,
right?
They were just cool. Like, Bow Wow didn't know how to dress when I met him. Crisscross, they knew how to dress. They was like fly. They was doing stuff that I was stealing from them, you know. Bow Wow differently. He came, he didn't know clothes wasn't his thing. It wasn't about clothing. It was a character inside that body, and that's what came out.
Okay. And you have the Music Moguls show, you know, with you and Dame and Snoop and Baby.
Some play the game, but they run the game. From the studio to the boardroom, their hustle never stops. Music Moguls, new series coming in June.
Yeah.
How has that been received so far?
So far, so good. I mean, you know, I think it's something that people have been wanting to see on TV for a long time. So I just think people are just sitting back looking and praying that different moments like me and Dame is going to happen on the show.
I'm trying to buy a football team. I'm not trying to buy a car.
This is the Dame Dash I work here.
That's the Dame Dash you do here.
Wait, what are you talking about?
I'm just saying.
I thought you were watching what I'm doing.
So I've interviewed Baby, and he is not the most talkative of people. How did you manage to have him be one of the main characters in the show?
He was a part before I even got involved.
Oh, wow.
But at some point, we all are not as talkative. I'm not probably the most talkative of all four of them. Mm-hmm. But I think that we all understand that we want people to see what it is that we all do. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, Birdman wanted people to see that he knows how to create and make things happen. So he wanted people to see this.
And you've been DJing in Vegas.
Yeah.
And can you tell me a little bit about that? How's that going? How'd you get into it? How does it pay?
I've been DJing in Vegas for about 9 years now.
Okay.
I was the first hip-hop artist to have a residency in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
It pays great. My next gig, I think, is August 11 at Tao. I have a new residency there. I've been there. I was at the Wynn for probably like 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So my new residency is at Tao. And it's great. You know what I mean? As for DJing, that's probably the best place in the world to DJ.
Right. You know, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about Atlanta. You know, you've obviously put out well-regarded compilations of bass music that, you know, people love and are classics, and some of those songs, as we know, have come back.
Mm-hmm.
My Boo by Ghost Town DJs, which was featured on the 1996 compilation So So Def Bass All-Stars, was repopularized in 2016 by the Running Man Challenge and actually ended up re-entering the Billboard Hot 100.
What was your relationship to that first generation of Atlanta-based music, the Kilo Alis of the world?
My home was very dear to me, love it very dearly, sleep from a little child to a funky dope MC.
Andrell Kilo Ali Rogers was one of the very first rap artists from Atlanta to gain recognition and was a pioneer of the Atlanta bass sound.
First generation bass music. I don't really have a relationship, but I don't know. What are you talking
like
about?
Like Kilo Ali and them. Were you aware of them at the time? Were you a fan?
Oh yeah, yeah. I was young. And I didn't have a record label at that time. Like with
of course.
Well, I had Silk Times Leather with I think Success and Effect and Raheem the Dream. These guys.
Raheem the Dream. Yeah.
Yeah.
Success Success and Effect, who began in 1988, and Raheem the Dream, who released his first single in 1986, were some of Atlanta's earliest rap stars.
I had Silk Times Leather. Mm-hmm. I was just an aspiring producer trying to get in at that particular point in time.
But you were aware of that scene?
Oh, yeah.
When it was going on?
It wasn't a lot, but it was there. It was definitely something that I was paying attention to.
Right, because in Welcome to Atlanta, you mentioned, just in passing, the club Frozen Paradise.
I've been putting it down here since 83, since the Lake Show MD rivalry, when Frozen Paradise was the place to be. If you was riding, you was bumping the homie Shadi. I'm the MB.
What do you remember about that spot?
That was the place that was like the most poppin'est spot in my neighborhood. What's crazy is that when I was that age, I never went to downtown Atlanta. I only went up the street in my neighborhood. So that was the biggest and most poppin'est spot in my neighborhood.
Mm. And, you know, one of the oddest things on So So Def, from my perspective, was that you guys signed and did a record with Daz Dillinger of the Dog Pound.
Yeah, I know what this is. So death.
I got trees in the jar, 23s on the car. You can bleed if I start. We on the boulevard. Got straps in my
life. How did you adjust his kind of like West Coast style, slang, all that to, you know, at that point you were doing a very Southern thing with So So Def. How did you meld those on the So Gangster album?
I actually wasn't trying to change him. I signed him specifically because I heard a mixtape that him and Corrupt did, and I was like, I need Daz signed. He's so, like, because when Daz gets on his shit, he got a style that can't be, you know, can't be matched. And I was looking for that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, speaking of career transitions, you know, you had the first Criss Cross album, obviously hugely successful. The second one, The Bomb, very different feel to it, right? Like the beats are a bit harder. Their subject matter has kind of changed, gotten, for lack of a better term, a bit more street.
No gang banging, ain't nothing like that. Just some homies on the corner trying to sell a dub sack. But if a sale goes wrong, then it's sound. Till he's gone, all night long.
Can you talk about that transition?
Yeah, I mean, the guys were so successful that they was running away from the success. And I actually helped them run away from the success on The Bomb, which I shouldn't have done. But the Criss Cross success was a hard one to follow up because Jump was just a song. It wasn't really a style of song. So if you would have went back in and made the same type of song, you could tell we was trying to copy. So we was just trying to, I was just trying to make a home for these kids to make sure people knew that they was rappers.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, your solo work, obviously, you've had a lot of success with. But I know you're not so happy with the Instructions album.
Yeah.
You said you made a lot of mistakes on it.
Yeah.
What mistakes?
Just rushing. Just rushing and trying to be overly. I think the biggest mistake I made was I didn't do a video on Hating Your Blood.
Listen, I know y'all niggas want me. I hear y'all niggas plotting. I see y'all niggas looking, but I ain't stopping. I'm going in something fast through the city with no top that reads 220 on the dash. I'm so hot.
And I should have done a video for Hating Your Blood because that, you know, what I got caught up in is what people succeeded in afterwards. Like, DJ Khaled could put out a rap record that's got rappers on it and people go crazy and they support it like it's a single. But Jermaine Dupri put out a record that's got like Jadakiss and Freeway on the hook. It's a hardcore rap record that Clue plays first on his mixtape and Flex plays all the time. But it's considered a hardcore rap record. Where's the single at? Like, you know what I mean? Where's that Money and a Thing single? Even with Money and a Thing wasn't received at Columbia the same way as Sweetheart was. They was looking for Sweetheart. Like, that Mariah Carey, Jermaine Dupri record, that's it.
Right.
You know, Money and a Thing probably would have been bigger too. But if they would have wrapped their hands around it. So on the second album, I did the same thing. I put out a record first, Hating Your Blood, which should be known as a great record, but it's not because it was treated like just a street record.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the mistakes that I made. When I have things that's real street, go all the way with it. Go as far as you can go with it, regardless of what, you know, the streets is the streets is the top level.
Mm-hmm.
don't treat your street record like it's a bottom record. And that's basically what was happening. That's what happened with that album.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the Snap music you oversaw in the mid-2000s, I remember that period very well.
Yeah.
it seemed like people were snapping to everything. That sound that you sort of, like I said, oversaw, executive produced with them Franchise Boys and whoever, Young Bloods and whatnot.
I bounce in the club, so the hoes call me Rocket. Posted in the cut, and I'm looking for a blockhead. Yep, in my white tee, I break a bitch back, and I keep a big bang. Oh, I think they like that.
Bang,
that has kind of come back now. I saw you do an interview with Sway where you did a mashup of Katy Perry's Dark Horse and Lean With It, Rock
everything.
With It.
It's crazy.
Just to demonstrate that they're the same tempo, same feel, same like snap sound on the two and four, all that.
Give me a Franchise Boy song too that you think it
Lean With It, Rock With It.
Yeah. Lean With It, Rock With It. Get that right.
Lean With It.
Okay. Oh.
He can switch it right now.
Woo! He knew it. He knew right where to do the break at. I like JD because he don't care about the high road.
Switch it back, switch it back.
Lee with it. Ow!
Can you talk about where you see Snap music now?
Well, Snap music now is everything that they call lit, crunk or turnt up or whatever it is. Like all of those artists actually conformed into doing more of what the trap music is. I would say that's what Snap turned into. Snap music, the Snap era turned into trap era, basically.
And what's it like for you now to see, you know, you did this thing that a lot of people loved, but a lot of people hated on as well, you know, particularly where we are now in New York.
Yeah.
And now it's all over the radio. What's that like to
look at? It just feels good. It feels good to be like the first person to be like, I was at the start of this.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully people at some point one day say Jermaine Dupri was the beginning of the way New York radio sounds without me having to say something about it.
Yeah. And, you know, one or two final things. You have a bunch of skits across your early albums, all with this kind of like hip-hop barbershop theme.
Hey, well, that was Silk Town Thunder's world premiere. And this is Skeeter Rocky. Don't stop at the hip-hop barbershop sucking on the pork chop.
Fat.
And also sitting on the couch, we got a new R&B group on Rough House Records named Chris Rose. Hey, this is Skeeter Rock from the Hip Hop Barbershop. And once again, that was a dedication sending out to all my partners percolating in the Windy City. What time for your mind? Who's on the request line? Tell me your name.
Can you talk about developing that, why you did that across all the different groups?
Well, on the Criss Cross album, it sold 8 million copies. So it felt like it was something that people probably would know.
Mm-hmm.
Just coming up with branding things for your brand, it was just like a thing that just try to brand the sound. And if you heard that hip hop barbershop thing, then you probably knew the music was going to be pretty good from that point on.
And you were already thinking back then of yourself as a roster because the first voices you hear on the Criss Cross album are Silk Times Leather.
Yeah.
So you were already like, oh, I got, even though that they didn't end up putting out a second record, they never became quite the big stars. You was like,
yeah,
they're on the very beginning of the first Criss Cross album, just talking.
Yeah, they were.
And introducing them. So you already had this idea of like one artist introduced the other.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted, like I said, that goes back to the Herbie Love Book thing. The Herbie Love Book, the artist, one artist helping the next artist become the next artist. So that was always something that I was trying to put forth, the Herbie Love Book movement.
And so finally, tell us, you know, you have the TV shows.
Yes.
What else is going on with you right now?
Well, I mean, that's, the TV shows a lot, basically. Moguls. And then on Moguls, I have two artists that's coming out of Moguls, which is Carson and Fresh Ali, a new Atlanta artist. Those are two artists that I'm, getting their projects together. Then everything that's happening on the rap game, at the end of this season, we're going to do a rap game tour with all of the kids from the first season and the winner of season two on one tour, all in the same place and all of that, so people can see them and whoever's fans of other people, this is what's going to happen on the tour. And then, the music, the artist who wins this season, working on their music, Miss Mulatto's music from season one, getting her music going. It's a lot of middle records that artists that I see I'm going to put out as well. finishing up this Brat. Me and Brat got a mixtape. Mm-hmm. We just released a record like Monday called F You Pay Me featuring The Dream.
200,000 in my halo, nigga, fuck your wrist. And the win is automatic, Dream, me and my sis.
Bruh, bruh, your little sister done growed up. Showed out when I showed up. And I'ma still keep leaning on your shoulder, cause I'm home now and I'm zeroed up.
$200,000 in my halo.
So, it's pretty heavy. My schedule's pretty covered.
Nice. And the little 10-year-old Jermaine that jumped on stage and danced with Diana Ross.
Yes.
Jermaine's father, Michael Maldon, was a Columbia Records executive and a manager in the Atlanta area. In 1982, Maldon put together a Diana Ross show, and Jermaine managed to make his way on stage and dance with Ross. Unsurprisingly, the crowd loved it.
What did you... I was so taken by that story. What did you... First off, do you remember doing that? And what do you think you learned by doing that and having that actually work out?
What I learned is that sometimes, regardless of what's going on, you got to do it. You know, my mother went to the bathroom and she told me to stay in my seat and don't move. And I was being the best kid that I could possibly be. But right at that moment, my mother went away. Diana Ross asked all the kids in the audience to come on stage with her. I wouldn't move. And the people that I didn't even know was in the audience, like, little boy, go up there. And I was like, nah, my mother told me, nah, I'm not getting my ass beat. You ain't gonna get me in trouble. So I was really like being the best kid that I could possibly be. And then so many people around me was like, go. We'll tell your mother it's all good. And I just took that opportunity. And at that particular point in time, I went up. And when I got up there, everybody else was on stage. So it made it seem like I was like, I'm the shit. I'm going to go up there when I want to come up. I'm going to let everybody else get up there first. Then I'm going to walk up there so all the eyes is on me. And that's pretty much what I learned. Like, all eyes was on me. People was looking at me, and it felt good. And I think I took that in, like, this is what I want. But seizing the opportunity is what I learned. You got to, you know, if you get an opportunity like that, or any opportunity that's big, period, you got to seize the opportunity.
Great. Sounds like a great note to end on.
Yeah.
Jermaine Dupri, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jermaine Dupri's influence is huge, far more than most fans would realize at first. I'm really glad we got a chance to discuss the full scope of his musical output, from Chad and Jermaine onwards. But more importantly, it was cool to hear about his vision in creating the acts where he wasn't performing, how his ideas and songs molded Escape, Jagged Edge, Bow Wow, Crisscross, Usher, and more. And we could have done a whole show just on the results of his sessions with Mariah Carey. Join us next week when our guest will be Slim Thug. Slim is a Houston rap icon who has been putting it down for the north side of his city since the late 1990s. We'll discuss Swisher House, his collaborations with mainstream figures like Pharrell and Beyonce, what exactly the deal is with the north side and south side of Houston, and a whole lot more. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode of The Cypher by subscribing on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program, and help us out with even a dollar a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotaro.
Well, that was my idol.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Yeah, I'm not that good.
Our intern is Maya Darby.
Go. We'll tell your mother it's all good.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
The world known.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
He had the wings to spread.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Gabe Cooper.
A lot of times I just hear him hitting riffs and I was just like, we should use this.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
This is how Say taught me how to write my name. So he taught me how to tag the Jermaine part. I put the Dupree under there, but he basically he had me writing my name all over, like just practice writing. I kind of got out of the habit of doing it, but he had me like where I could, like he was like, you gotta learn how to tag your name first before you start doing pieces. So.